the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
It's the weekend before Election Day in the United States, and Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are making their last pitches to voters. With Register writer Peter Laffin, we examined the campaign's final messaging as well as their outreach to Catholics throughout this season. But first, we get insights into the final report of the Synod on Synodality that ended last weekend at the Vatican. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio. I'm together with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host and EWTN News' vice president and editorial director. Matthew just returned from Rome, so good to have you back, Matthew.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So this multi-year Synod on Synodality concluded last weekend with the publishing of a 52-page final report. And I think it's always good to remember what is this whole Synod thing about. And the Synod report makes clear, just as the Synod from the beginning made clear, that the end goal is evangelization, making the church more participatory and inclusive. So Jonathan Liddle has been in Rome. He's back now, but he's been in Rome for the month of October covering this gathering, and he joins us now. Welcome, Jonathan.
Great to be with you both.
So, Jonathan, we've been covering this since 2020, in fact, when Pope Francis, in March of that year, first announced that there would be a Synod on Synodality. And over these 4 years, it might be easy to forget how new this whole process has been. So to start off a discussion about the close of the Synod, I really wanted to visit some of the novelty of this whole thing. What have been some of the first of this Synod?
Well, absolutely, Jeanette. You kind of tipped us off right there by describing it as a four-year process, right? Mm-hmm. This wasn't just a one-and-done come to Rome for a month and we'll hash out an issue. But Pope Francis really initiated this entire synodal process back in October of 2021. And so it's been multi-year, and it's also been multi-stage, this effort to consult widely in the church. We've had diocesan levels. We've had national levels. We've had continental levels, and then this whole idea of circularity, things coming up to the top and going back, in this effort to try to gauge Catholics across the world. So that was kind of the setup, and that we can't separate what happened in Rome this past October and last October as well from that whole process. But then we get to the actual Synod of Bishops in Rome, and a couple things jump out to us. The widespread participation of lay voting members, right? Mm-hmm. So this session, this past October, 368 voting members of the Synod, 96 of them, about 27%, were non-bishops. So that's a pretty significant change. And of course, Pope Francis, requested that, right? He said, everyone who's a member, I want them to be able to vote. And the idea wasn't to have a perfect balance of bishops and lay people, but to sort of represent the whole church by having other vocations other than the episcopacy present. We also think of the method in which the synod was conducted, this session and last session, this whole notion of conversation in the spirit. So instead of sitting in an auditorium style arrangement and speeches being presented before the whole assembly, the focus was instead on small group tables. And this method of conversation in the spirit, where everybody spoke, everybody listened, and it was punctuated by little prayerful moments of silence as well. So that was certainly a novelty. And then finally, I think the big thing, which we'll perhaps unpack here, is that we're used to a pope receiving the final report from a synod and then writing what's called a post-synodal apostolic exhortation. This time around, Pope Francis didn't do that. He didn't wait. On the night that the final document was approved by the assembly, he adopted it into his ordinary magisterium. So that document, that 52-page document we talked about, becomes part of Pope Francis's sort of ordinary teaching from his, from his position as the successor of Peter. So that, I think, we're really going to be unpacking what the significance of that is and what that means going forward.
Yeah, Jonathan, the synod organizers at the press conference on Saturday night after the release of the document, and Pope Francis made this decision, where at some pains it seemed to stress that this was not then a normative document, in other words, a set of rules that Pope Francis is now suddenly going to impose on everyone, but a series of guidelines. And yet he seems to have elevated the importance of and the influence of this document. What was his thinking, can you assess, in taking this step?
You know, I think, Matthew, it really comes down to a symbolic move, right? To take the final document from this, as we said, multi-year, multi-stage, widely consultative process, and then to sort of give the papal seal of approval on it. I think it's less about the Pope sort of saying whatever sentence or paragraph or proposal here needs to become enshrined. And it's really, I think, the Pope, putting that really giving his full backing to the process that produced this whole thing. And then one thing, you know, the vote was on Saturday and the final mass is on Sunday. And actually the chair of St. Peter, right, the wooden chair of St. Peter that was given to the papacy in the year 875, it's recently been restored. It was brought out at the conclusion of this synod, the first time it's been publicly displayed since 1867. And I think that also is a kind of just a hugely symbolic moment that Pope Francis is saying synodality, this way of governing the church, this way of thinking about participating in the church, is the normative model that I, as Pope, want to approve and want to insist that we adopt going forward.
Yeah, and can one say that this is, for him, a very significant exercise in synodality?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we go back to Evangelii Gaudium 2013, you know, the document that many say is the blueprint of Pope Francis's papacy. He uses this word synodality there. We follow up 2 years later in 2015 on the 60th anniversary of the establishment of Synod of Bishops by St. Paul VI. And that's when Pope Francis says synodality is a constitutive dimension of the church. It's what God expects from the church in the 21st century. So really, Matthew, you and I have been doing this off the air for years, right? Like looking at these different developments and saying, where is this all going? You know, and even what we just mentioned, the Pope changing canon law in 2018 to allow him to adopt the final document of a synod as magisterial. All of these pieces have been put in place along the way. So I think it'd really be a mistake to look at what happened, you know, this past weekend on Saturday and say, oh, this was just the conclusion of 1 month or even just the conclusion of 4 years. I think it's really a better read on it to say this is really kind of the legacy of Pope Francis. This is perhaps the most significant thing that he wants to contribute to the church going forward, is to sort of symbolically enshrine synodality as the modus operandi of the Catholic Church. So that's the move so far, and of course, you know, we'll see what the implications and results are.
Well, but then we still have to look at what's actually in this report. So what were some of the highlights for you? I know women deacons, that question, decentralization, other things, but for you, what are your major takeaways?
Well, I the women deacons thing I'll bring up just because what's really interesting, the final document, in very kind of strong language, insists that the question of diaconal ministry for women is still open and that discernment needs to continue on that. What's interesting is that that language was not in the draft. The draft version that delegates received at the beginning of the week, then they submitted amendments, and they only got the final draft back on Saturday morning, voting for it later in that day. And of course, among all the proposals, that one had the most significant pushback. 97 members voted against it. So just over 25% there as well. So that one, I think, really jumps at least to show that sometimes, you know, throughout the month, we were highlighting kind of lobbies and sort of activist pushes, especially on issues like, you know, so-called women's ordination. And I think if you look at how things shook out in the final week and how that appeared in the document, it seemed to have some impact. And of course, there are these study groups that Pope Francis set up, one of them looking at this question on the possibility of women deacons, and its work will continue until June of next year. So that's something to keep an eye on. But really, I think what I would say, Matthew, is that I think the final document, it it keeps the door open without doing anything decisive on a number of different issues. So you mentioned decentralization of doctrinal authority, which I know we'll talk about a little bit more, or we talk about reforming canon law to take into account a more synodal approach, so more lay involvement in decision making in the church. The document is full of sort of open-ended ideas or proposals that, hey, this is something we need to do, but it really doesn't deliver, as you said before, much that's normative, right? Much that's like decisive and concrete about how this stuff is going to happen. It's kind of an affirmation of synodality and the need to apply it at a number of levels of the church, without really being clear exactly how that looks like. And I think that's going to be the humongous question kind of going forward from the Synod on Synodality of what that looks like and what those steps are.
Jonathan, you know, you mentioned decentralization and church governance. That's a whole entire show in and of itself. We've covered it a lot as we've talked about the Synod, but how does the final document and where we are right now, how does it change, or did it change anything about the way the church is governed?
Yeah, great question. I think it did not decisively change anything. I think what it did do, though, is again suggest some openness to experimentation. So mm-hmm. I think the final document, it affirms that when it comes to decentralizing doctrinal authority, and especially thinking about the authority of national bishops' conferences, that nothing should be done that undermines the unity of the church. At the same time, it asks for clarification, for further study on what exactly the authority of these episcopal conferences are. And then at other places, the document calls for local context, including at the national level, to begin to put some of these synodal reforms in place. And, you know, if we look at the people who've most been championing decentralization, it's the German supporters of the synodal way in that country, a very controversial proposal. They received this document, and maybe this is what they're going to do anyway, no matter what it said, but they really kind of said, you know, there's nothing in here that is a stop sign for us and what we're trying to do in Germany. So at the very least, they see it as an open path forward on some of these questions related to decentralizing doctrinal authority.
Well, so what I'm hearing is that the synod on synodality in terms of a synod itself and that gathering has concluded, but there's so much more still yet to come in these commissions and what they communicate and how this is unpacked. So I'm sure, Jonathan, you'll be covering this for us for a very long time. Our listeners can go to ncregister.com and find Synod on Synodality in the navigation bar there at the top and find all these stories. We've got a new article by Frank Rocca, our Vatican analyst. It's premature to judge the Synod just yet is what it says. And, of course, in the November 3rd as well as the November 17th print editions, we have a lot of coverage of the Synod. So thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Register Radio on EWTN. When we come back, Register writer Peter Laffin joins us with more on the race to the White House. Stay tuned to Register Radio on EWTN.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio, together with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host and EWTN News' vice president and editorial director. And here we are in the days immediately before Election Day, November 5th. Peter Laffin joins us with insights into how the candidates are spending their final moments on the campaign trail. And we are especially interested in how the two presidential candidates have reached out to Catholic voters. And Peter, who's our staff writer at the Register, has been following this. Peter, here we are. We're grateful to be talking to you in these final moments. And I guess the question is, what's the state of the race right now, the race to the White House? And if we could, then, you know, get a good look at what the final statements of the two campaigns are.
Yeah. Jeanette and Matthew, it's so great to be with you both. It's hard to believe we're at the end. Mm-hmm. And it's harder to believe that this started 2 years ago. does anybody remember the Republican primaries at this point and all of the ink we spilled over that, which, you know, just may as well be ancient history? So, yeah, today here we are at the end. And while, you know, many political watchers have some real concrete feelings about how this race is going, we can anchor ourselves into some good objective data to glean what we can about this race at this point. And I think any honest person would tell you at this point who reads the polls that there has been a significant shift toward Donald Trump in the past 3 weeks. Not an enormous shift, but a significant one, one that many think is enough to tilt the balance of the race. Right now, Donald Trump is winning in the aggregate of polls, aggregate of the national polls, which is something that he never had when he was running in 2016 or 2020. And in fact, 4 years ago at this point, when he was running against Joe Biden, he was losing by about 8 points. And so the fact that he's, you know, half a point or a point ahead right now feels significant. We also have some early voting data that seems to back up that story of the polling shift. Mm-hmm. I think the most significant early number that we have is out of Nevada. There's a great journalist in Nevada named John Ralston. He's known as the Dean of Nevada Journalists, very straight shooter, even though he's frequently a guest on MSNBC, but very straight shooter. And what he's saying he's seeing out of early voting in Nevada is that there is an unprecedented level of Republican support at this time in an election. Usually Democrats like to go into an election day with something like a 400,000 vote firewall, so that Democrats have historically been much better at gathering ballots and bringing them in for early voting. Republicans generally vote on election day. But this year in Nevada, he's actually today, as of this day, he's up by about 20,000 votes in Nevada, which is absolutely unheard of. We're seeing similar numbers out of Florida, where Trump is leading in Miami-Dade County, where he was beat by Biden by 12 points. So some real significant numbers in the early voting. We're also seeing some campaign activity and behavior that also signals that this shift might be real. The most important campaign tactic that we've seen change that might point to this is that Kamala Harris, was reported a couple of days ago, pulled out of advertising buying in North Carolina, which, you know, is a very significant thing given how close that is to the poll. So right now, all signs are pointing toward Trump having a very good night. However, you know, and we have to make the caveat, anything could change.
Of course. Yeah. What about messages? Just to add, you know, to that, I know I gave you a whammy question with the state of the race, but also what have their messages been? If you could say they're making final statements, what are they making?
So, you know, the messaging in the end has been pretty scattershot on both sides. Both sides wanted to put out a particular message, but some controversies in recent days has overshadowed on both ends. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris had a very well put together and by all accounts, very well delivered speech at the Ellipse in D.C. A few nights ago, where she made a case for, you know, I'd say for her, a very positive and strong case for her vision of America being a place where, you know, everyone is respected, you know, building on her campaign theme of freedom. Whereas on the other side, Donald Trump gave the extravaganza a rally at Madison Square Garden over the weekend. And he wanted to build a very joyful, you know, a very joyful, very enthusiastic case that his party had all the momentum. We're going to make America great again. And then one of his comedians calls Puerto Rico a garbage island. And that is the only headline. So it's hard to say that either side is doing a great job getting their messaging out. But they're attempting to. It's just the problem is in the execution.
And Peter, you've written about the outreach to Catholics. Both candidates at times have not done a particularly stellar job of that, particularly with Trump's shift on abortion. But it does seem, as you have analyzed, the Harris campaign seems to be struggling with its outreach to Catholics.
Yeah. You know, when we say the Catholic vote, and this is something that we see a lot in the comment section of the articles we write about the Catholic vote, whether it's on Twitter or people say, well, what does that mean? Does that mean somebody who goes to Mass every day? What do we say? And when I am talking about this now in the analysis piece I wrote a few days ago, I'm talking about people who self-identify as Catholics. And, you know, look around the pews on an average Sunday, we'll see that, you know, there are a lot of Democrats sitting around us. There are a lot of Republicans sitting around us. There's a great deal of political diversity in the Catholic Church, and our own numbers back that up. So that's who we're talking about now, people who call themselves Catholic. What's interesting, though, is even with all of the divisions, political divisions within Catholicism, there are some things that we all kind of hold sacred. You know, I'd say anybody who self-identifies as Catholic would probably say, I love Jesus. or, you know, I love the Eucharist, probably. And what happened with the Harris campaign in Michigan with Gretchen Whitmer, it's hard to even describe how strange this video was. And I don't really understand the online trend that was happening, but the governor of Michigan mocked the Eucharist openly in a very bizarre way. And right. Michigan is obviously a swing state. She's a very, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor, is a very high profile, surrogate for the Harris campaign. So you see things like that and you just can't imagine, well, that really helped or that really worked. And also Kamala Harris has come out very strong saying that there will be no religious exemptions for abortion. And you know, Catholics, you know, as we know in our polling, different Catholics think differently about the issue, but I would say on a whole, most Catholics have at least some discomfort with abortion, probably more than the general public. And so you wonder, how does that land on the Catholic voters? Let's imagine there's a Catholic voter who really doesn't like Donald Trump and is really uncomfortable with his behavior and some of the things he says. And they're, okay, maybe I could vote for Kamala Harris, except really, no religious exemption on abortion? You're going to make Catholic hospitals give abortion? Like, I can't do that either. So a lot of missteps from Harris. And then for Trump, you know, you have to say his outreach toward Catholic voters seems to be very focused. There was an ad last week from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. That's been all over TV, all over social media, of him talking about his Catholic upbringing, very heavy on Catholic symbolism. You could imagine cultural Catholics, especially people who are Democrats, like Kennedy used to be forever, being drawn in to that. And we see J.D. Vance being used very effectively as a surrogate. In some op-eds, in some appearances, making the case for religious freedom. It does seem like the Trump campaign is just doing a better job on it.
Yeah, well, we had the misstep at the Al Smith dinner and other missteps along the way, as you've documented. But right now, do we have any sense of where Catholics are leaning, how Catholics are responding, and in particular in these battleground states?
So, you know, I want to say yes. You know, based on what we know about the early polling, early voting data, the polling, I'm hesitant to say for certain that we can objectively say these Catholic voters are swinging in one way or the other. But what we can do is just make the inference based on how these messages seem to be landing. And, you know, at this point in the race, I think we just have to throw up our hands and wait for the Tuesday results.
Yes, and you did write, you know, I want to point to the story that you wrote about this particular thing, the connection with Catholic voters. It's titled, Harris Campaign is Stalling with Catholic Voters While Trump is Connecting. And this is on ncregister.com. It was posted October 29th. And you talk in this article just about how important Catholics are, especially in places like Pennsylvania. I think the polls say that 30% in 2020, 30% of the state's overall vote was Catholic, obviously self-identifying. And so it is a really important segment of people. But as we've been saying all along, it's very, very diverse. So it's a fascinating story to read, Peter. I'm grateful that you kind of delved into it, into some of the issues that Catholics are looking at. In our last few minutes, I just wanted to point to another story that you wrote about Florida, because, you know, while Florida is not a battleground state, it is a state with a lot of Catholics, but it's not a battleground state. They've been in the spotlight for their own, you know, battle within the state. Could you just, in a minute, give us a summary of what's going on in Florida?
So right now in Florida, there are two big ballot amendments that should be of interest to Catholic voters that are certainly of interest to the bishops in Florida. The first is Amendment 4, which would codify abortion rights in the state constitution and basically overturn the six-week ban. That needs 60% to pass. Polling suggests that they're getting just about 60%. So this one's really going to come down to the wire. And many people have said, well, if pro-life can't win in Florida with a Republican governor on a 60% measure, then where can it win? So there's huge implications for the future of the pro-life movement right now in Florida. There's also Amendment 3, which is a marijuana legislation amendment. And if it's passed, marijuana recreation will be legalized in Florida. The Catholic bishops in Florida have come out very strongly against this. And there's also the Senate race. Rick Scott is a former governor and incumbent senator, is up for re-election. He's facing a very strong challenger. And this could determine the balance of the Senate. The Senate might come down to 51-49, 50-50. And if Kamala Harris wins and has a 50-50 Senate, she can override the filibuster and codify abortion nationally. So huge implications here in this race also.
Absolutely. Well, as always, thanks so much, Peter Laffin, for your coverage at ncregister.com. And there's a lot more coverage there at ncregister.com. So check it out, the National Catholic Register online, for news, analysis, and commentary. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of my producer, Michael McCall, and my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, I'm Jeanette DeMello, and I pray that until next week, God bless you.